So, it looks like it's Trump. Now what? I'm Jeannie Yandel, in for Bill Radke, and welcome to The Record. Here in Washington State, Republicans are deeply divided about their apparent nominee, Donald Trump. What's more, they are uncertain about the future of their party. David Hyde has more.
Donald Trump and his supporters are feeling pretty good today. But the reaction among some Washington State Republicans, like former Attorney General Rob McKenna, is a lot less enthusiastic.
I can't support Trump. I think he's a demagogue and an opportunist with no real foundation in principles or values that I can detect.
Leading Republicans opposing their own party's nominee for president. It's almost unheard of. A political earthquake.
I do think this is a pivotal moment in the Republican Party's history. The Reagan-Goldwater era of the party is coming to a close because it just doesn't have broad enough appeal. Even though I'm a Reagan Republican, I see the handwriting on the wall.
And Rob McKenna says to win, the Republican Party needs to change.
To morph into something that has a broader appeal to voters of color, to women voters, to younger voters especially.
But state GOP chairman Susan Hutchinson is a lot more optimistic. She thinks Donald Trump is going to help Republicans in Washington state this year.
More than ever, we've got an opportunity to not only take the House, but also to take the governor's race and to win the Senate race and other statewide races simply because we're going to be getting a huge group of voters who have felt disenfranchised.
And University of Washington political history professor Margaret O'Meara thinks she may have a point.
Anti-establishment populist messages have played well here in the past. It's a place that in 1912 went for the third party candidate, Teddy Roosevelt. It's a place that in 1992 a sizable chunk of votes went to third-party candidate Ross Perot.
So does that mean Donald Trump could actually do well in Washington state this year?
Playing the Washington outsider card could get Donald Trump some traction. Now, will it get him enough to win what is now a reliably blue state? I doubt it.
But even if Donald Trump loses in a landslide and drags state and local Republicans down with him, O'Meara says Washington State Republicans should not give up hope because history.
In 1964, having Goldwater at the top of the ticket was bad news for Republicans all the way down. But in 1966, a short 2 years later, the GOP got a lot of really important victories at the congressional and in congressional races in the Senate.
People like George H.W. Bush from Texas.
Things can change pretty quickly, and maybe what both parties need to keep in mind is keep their eyes on the long game, not just 2016.
I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Let's take a look now at one of those Senate races here in Washington, where four-term U.S. Senator Patty Murray faces a challenge from Republican Chris Vance. He's a former chair of the state Republican Party, and this morning he distanced himself from his party's nominee, saying Donald Trump's policies would drive up our debt and destroy jobs. On foreign policy, he called Trump naive and dangerous. Chris Vance told Bill Radke what he'll be doing instead of backing Trump.
I will be voting for John Kasich in the May presidential primary. In November, I'll vote for a credible conservative third-party candidate if one emerges. Otherwise, I simply will not cast a vote for president.
What are you telling voters to do?
Well, I'm telling voters to vote for me for the U.S. Senate. This is a terrible conundrum that Republicans find themselves in. And I respect the fact that other Republicans are going to make different choices. But I just have to put principle and conscience ahead of party loyalty. I'm hoping it's a 24-hour story and we can get back to what we want to talk about. I'm running against Patty Murray. I'm not running against Donald Trump.
Well, Chris, like it or not, Donald Trump apparently is going to be the Republican nominee, the standard bearer. The Republican National Committee, their chair, Reince Priebus, says now is the time to unite behind Donald Trump. You're, in a sense, walking away from your party leadership, and aren't you counting on the Republican Party right now to help you in your run against Senator Patty Murray?
Yes, and I think everybody in the Republican Party recognizes that we're all going to make different choices, that this is a very unusual year and a very unusual circumstance. But whatever happens, I have to live with myself, and I can't I have to put principle and conscience ahead of politics and party loyalty. I hope that Republicans will continue to support my candidacy. I'm not the only Republican making this decision, Bill.
No, in fact, Rob McKenna, the former Washington Attorney General who has been backing Kasich, he says he's not going to vote for Trump, and his concern is the effect that a Trump nomination would have on people like you. He's concerned about Republicans losing a lot of seats in Congress. Do you think that's true, that the Trump ticket could cost you your election and the governor's race, et cetera?
Well, if voters don't support Donald Trump, I hope they understand neither do I. This is an incredibly unusual year. And I hope this becomes a year when people will disaggregate their down-ballot decisions from the top of the ticket.
Let me make one pro-Donald Trump pitch to you. Okay, imagine I am a Washington State Republican Party leader, and I take you aside and say, Chris, Trump is a rookie. He's not going to ban Muslims. He's not going to deport 10 million people and build a wall that Mexico will pay for. He just says stuff, and it is general election time almost. He will pivot to the middle. He'll hire a smart team of advisors, and he's going to be, it's a lot better that Trump put people on the U.S. Supreme Court than President Hillary Clinton. Trump is better than Clinton.
And that is what the Trump supporters say. Again, I want to emphasize, I can't support either party's nominee. And I look at what Donald Trump has said, for instance, about the economy, particularly relating to Washington State. 40% of our jobs are directly related to international trade. I take him at his word that he wants to throw up trade barriers against Mexico, against China. That will massively impact Boeing, but also our agricultural workers. You know, we ship a lot of apples to Mexico, for instance. If Donald Trump does what he says he's going to do in terms of trade, it will destroy jobs in Washington State. How can I support that? How can I vote for that? I can't.
Chris, let's talk a little about the future of the Republican Party, because I'm not clear whether you are walking away from the Republican Party into who knows what, or whether you think the Republican Party has just left its senses temporarily. Is this an existential threat to the R in front of your name?
No, I've been a Republican all my life. But, you know, Bill, I'm a member of the party of Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan and Dan Evans, and Slade Gorton, and Jennifer Dunn. And this nominee does not fit with that legacy. I think after November, there's going to be a reckoning and a major discussion about the future of the Republican Party. But for right now, it's about winning elections.
That's Chris Vance, former chair of Washington State Republicans, now challenging Senator Patty Murray, and saying this morning that he won't be supporting Donald Trump as his party's presidential nominee. This morning, state Democrats say Vance is trying to, quote, back away from the Republican brand. They called him a loyal Republican Party insider who will fight for policies that will deeply harm America's middle-class families. You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Seattle has had its share of champion sports teams, from the Seattle Storm in 2004 and 2010 to the 2014 Super Bowl champion Seahawks. But none of those teams can touch Seattle's real sports dynasty, the University of Washington men's crew team. 5 consecutive national championships, plus a legacy that goes back more than a century. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman has this story.
A long wooden rowing shell hangs from the ceiling in the Husky Crew Team dining hall. It looks like a boat you would find in any nautical-themed restaurant around town, but this shell, the Husky Clipper, is special. It raced in the 1936 Olympics.
Now the last 100 yards. Great Britain leading on the far side, Italy coming up, Germany nearest to us third, Hungary fourth. There's America, way over there.
The University of Washington crew team that rowed this boat won the race by a yard. You may have read their story in the bestseller, The Boys in the Boat. But these rowers were legend long before that book was ever published.
We honor the 36 crew. Every freshman knows that.
That's Michael Callahan, the head rowing coach at the UW. Callahan says every freshman learns the names of the 1936 crew. But they also honor the man who built the Husky Clipper, George Pocock.
When you say Pocock here, it's almost the spirit of the boathouse, the spirit of rowing. Pocock's name and philosophies are synonymous with our program and have lived here for over 100 years, and we would not be the same program without them.
Boat builder George Pocock and his brother Dick emigrated from England to Vancouver, B.C. in the early 20th century. In 1912, the UW lured the brothers to Seattle. Dick left to work at Yale, but George Pocock set up shop at the U, and that's where he built boats and dispensed rowing advice to the students and to their coaches. A century later, Seattle's evolved from a sleepy timber town to a high-tech metropolis, but the sport of rowing hasn't changed all that much. It's still about rowers and oars, power and rhythm. Early one sunny morning, coxswain Leah Roberts calls out instructions to eight guys dressed in fluorescent green shirts and black tights.
Okay, let's get hands on.
They hoist a slim white boat up to their shoulders and carry it out to the water. Once they're settled in the shell, they paddle toward the Montlake Cut. The Huskies are prepping for their first race of the spring season. Kristen Brownlee drives a launch alongside the crew, shouting instructions through her megaphone.
15 high, 20 stride. Here we go. Attention. Go.
At Brownlee's call, the coxswains get to work.
Into, that's one, two strikes and pop, pop, pop.
Two boats start off side by side, but at Roberts' urging, her eight rowers surge ahead. This is Washington's third varsity crew, the 3V, and they're rowing the latest model from Pocock Racing Shells. Bill Titus has owned Pocock Racing Shells for more than 30 years. He bought the company from George Pocock's son, who planned to shut it down. It wasn't strictly a business deal, though. Titus wanted to preserve George Pocock's legacy. Titus first encountered the boat builder more than 50 years ago, when he was riding his bike through what's now the university's Montlake parking lot.
It was the town dump, and it had these portable barbecues. It had a whole row of these things with eternal flames that would come burning off the methane gas because it's a peat bog out there.
One day, Titus rode past the dump to a wooden building on the shoreline.
I'd go peek in there, and there are these, you know, there's all these old guys working away, and you kind of put one foot in, nobody yells, put 2 feet in, and pretty soon someone will talk to you. And then there was this marvelous old man with this lilting English accent.
That marvelous old man was George Pocock. He and his boats helped build the university into a local sports powerhouse. Back then, rowing news was front page news.
The crews would row by because they rowed out in the lake in those days. And, of course, all the kids run down to the nearest dock and yell, stroke, 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 like every kid does, or used to.
So in 1936, it was a big deal when the Husky crew made it to the Berlin Olympics, and an even bigger deal here when the team won gold. Although rowing is still an Olympic sport, Bill Titus says it doesn't play well on TV.
Rowing's biggest problem is you can't watch rowing and have a sense of what's going on there. You have no sense of how hard those people are working because it looks so graceful. It looks so easy. The boats go by, parade boats go by, and it looks like everyone's just out for a jaunt.
Collegiate crews don't represent the U.S. at the Olympics anymore. Some of the UW athletes may qualify to row in the Rio Games this summer. Before then, they'll focus on winning another national championship for their school. For senior Sam Helms, the boys in that 1936 Olympic boat are an inspiration.
Honestly, when I'm deep in the pain cave and my legs are burning, I can't breathe, that's one of the things that's on my mind is knowing that those guys who, you know, worked real hard, didn't have the same resource that we did by a long shot, that's where they were rowing, and now that's where we're rowing.
Helms and his teammates never met George Pocock. He died 40 years ago. But Pocock's presence is felt in the boats that bear his name. the methods he instilled in the Washington coaches, and these words recorded in a 1973 film.
It's a great art, is rowing. It's the finest art there is. It's symphony of motion. It touches the you of you, which is your soul.
At the UW Shell House on Union Bay, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
Go have fun at school. Learn something. Report back later.
You can see video and photos of the UW men's crew team and visit the Pocock Racing Shells Factory at our website, kuow.org. We also just tweeted out a video of the UW men's crew team in action. We're at KUOW. And you can catch rowing action live on Saturday morning when the Husky crew hosts the 30th annual Windermere Cup races on the Montlake Cut. Here in Washington, carbon pollution is on a deadline. The State Department of Ecology is now required by law to deliver an emissions reduction rule by the end of this year. That's new, and it's because of kids. 8 youth plaintiffs took the Department of Ecology to court, and they won. Attorney Andrea Rogers represented the youth plaintiffs, including Aji Piper, who's 15, and his brother Adonis, who's 11. Roger said it was an unusual case because both sides agreed on the basic facts. Carbon pollution is dangerous to the environment and has serious consequences for future generations. They were only arguing about the right time and way to act on it.
The Department of Ecology's argument was, trust us. We'll take care of you. And the court found that she had no confidence that Ecology would promulgate a rule protecting these kids' rights by the end of the year. So she entered an order holding them accountable and requiring that they do so.
Adi, I'll ask you, why was this an important thing for you guys to do?
A lot of times in the climate movement, like a lot of the things you do, especially as youth or children, it really kind of goes pretty unheard. Like, you know, it's not like front page news all the time. This is front page news, and it's a lot bigger of a thing than, oh, we went to some protests, we went to some rallies, we spoke, and, you know, different things like that. And then this is also operating inside of the law. So if you win operating inside of the law, there's nothing they can really do against it, which is, you know, it's just kind of like, whoa, we won, and there's nothing they can really say about it.
Adonis, how did you and your brother get involved with this in the first place?
So it started out when our mom was going to New Mexico. She put us in an academy for Plant for the Planet.
Wait. That's a long story to tell. That's like how we got involved in the climate movement.
How did you get involved in this case? Yeah, that's what I'm asking, Aji. That's right.
We are part of Plant for the Planet Seattle. Plant for the Planet Seattle is a subsection of Plant for the Planet, which is an international youth-led organization.
Started by Felix Kingsbanner.
Okay. Not important. The Department of Ecology issued a statement saying that the current climate plan was inadequate as far as dealing with climate change, and more radical action needed to be taken. So 8 members of Plant for the Planet, along with some help from the adults, filed a petition to the Department of Ecology saying, hey, you
update
just said this stuff, so update your recommendations to the legislature. And they denied our petition. So with the help of Our Children's Chest, we took them to court. And that's how we got involved.
Andrea Rogers, you're the attorney on this case. And you brought lawsuits on behalf of children here. Our Children's Trust, which was a partner organization with this, brought lawsuits on behalf of children all over the country. Why use kids as plaintiffs?
Well, I would phrase the question a different way. I don't think we're using kids as plaintiffs. And I think the case in Washington is a good example of that. Plant for the Planet, Aji and Adonis and the other kids were doing a variety of different things in educating the public about climate change. Lemonade stands, planting trees, different educational, testifying before councils. And they really wanted to take it to another level. I think they were interested in getting their voices heard by a far broader audience. And so I think that's when, you know, they approached us and we kind of hatched this idea for the petition for rulemaking, which was originally filed in 2014. And, you know, as youth, they are the ones who are most affected by climate change. When I was writing some of the briefs, I would ask the kids, I'd send them an email and say, how old are you guys going to be in 2080 after reading that some of the most severe impacts are going to be happening in 2080? You know, just to get a sense of what's going on. And, you know, their rights are significantly affected by climate change, and they don't vote. And the legislative and the executive branches have failed to do what needs to be done to address climate change. And the kids don't have a remedy other than they have rights, legal rights, that are supposed to be enforced and protected by the judicial branch. And that's why going to court is the appropriate and necessary thing to protect their rights.
There are people who object to making laws about climate change and controlling carbon emissions too quickly. They say this could cost us jobs. So they may look at this case and they may say, that's great. There are some kids. They got the law changed, but that is not a sound way to make law or make policy. Aji, what's your response to that criticism?
Are you an expert on law or policy? That's my first question. And if they are, then are you an expert on the economy? And if they are, then my next question is, why can't you think outside of the box of fossil fuels and jobs? You know, doesn't make logical sense to be like, this costs us jobs, but then look at the consequences of not doing this. The consequences of not doing this are far more costly than the consequences of us actually implementing these laws.
Adonis, what do you think about that criticism?
So I would ask the same three questions that Aji asked. And then when they're like, this would cost jobs, you know, this would cost money, to the money one, everything costs money.
Andrea, now that this decision is in, what's next?
Next is ensuring that ecology, when they promulgate their rule, they do so in a manner that complies with the court's order. So specifically, they need to protect air quality for present and future generations. They need to ensure that public trust resources are not substantially impaired. And they need to protect the fundamental constitutional rights of these young people to a livable planet.
That's attorney Andrea Rogers, along with brothers Aji and Adonis Piper. The Piper brothers are two of the eight youth plaintiffs who took Washington's Department of Ecology to court. And their win means ecology is required to deliver a rule to reduce carbon pollution by the end of this year. KUOW asked the Department of Ecology to respond to this story, and in a statement they said, quote, climate change is a global issue. Science is telling us that what was projected years ago is happening today, and we need to act now to protect our environment and economy for future generations. We're working vigorously on Washington's first ever rule to cap and reduce carbon pollution and help slow climate change. We're on schedule to adopt a rule in the coming months and continue our state's leadership in addressing climate change, end quote. Up to 40% of the food we buy ends up in landfills. Seattle has been trying to tackle the issue with laws that require composting, but for one local cyclist, that's not enough. KUOW's Matt Martin has this profile.
You're going to have to cut really, really sharply across this so you don't get stuck in the track.
This is Tim Jenkins. He jets through an intersection before the light changes. He has a child trailer attached to the back of his bike. But instead of carrying a small human, Jenkins hopes to fill that cart with food.
Food rescue is a lot easier when it's all downhill.
Seattle Food Rescue is the group that Tim started 2 years ago. The vision is to stop food waste and provide healthy food options to low-income residents in central Seattle. We stop at a corner store called Stockbox.
Like, look at what we got today. This is spectacular. These loaves of bread are like $5. It's always organic. stuff that's locally produced in Washington. Like, I love that. I love that aspect of food rescue. And this is all food that you would just, like, go to the store and totally buy.
Most food banks already get donations from chain grocery stores. But the system often overlooks smaller stores like Stockbox. Tim says that's why bikes are so effective. They allow for small pickups that might otherwise be overlooked. Tim sees the bike rescue model as the perfect marriage of his passions for cycling and social justice.
So I think there is kind of a cool opportunity to have sort of a weird kind of economy going. You just have people who are in the downtown area, and they recognize that this shop on the corner is going to be throwing out some food, and you know, there may be some other people who could take advantage of that fact.
But this type of bike-powered food rescue isn't unique to Seattle. Tim got the idea from a group he worked with as an undergrad in Boulder, Colorado.
And I'm just like, this would be something great to bring to Seattle.
And the idea has spread to more than just Seattle. There are now people like Tim in 11 cities across the country.
Food rescue is something that is really taking a lot of spotlight right now in terms of an environmental movement as well as a social movement.
That's Helen Kadich. She helped Tim set up Seattle Food Rescue. Kadich works for an umbrella organization that trains people all over the country to do that same thing. And she says the idea to snatch up still useful food isn't anything new.
Food rescue has been going on forever. There's been people gleaning farms since the dawning of farms.
Kadich says that what has worked for Tim on Capitol Hill could be a model for hyper-local food rescue in other parts of the city.
Maybe there could be a Beacon Hill food rescue. Maybe there could be a Rainier food rescue. Maybe there could be a Tacoma food rescue. And all it takes is reaching out and asking for that support on how to get started.
The city of Seattle is working to keep food out of the waste stream. It requires that grocery stores compost food they are throwing out. But the city supports efforts like Seattle Food Rescue. A city spokesman says composting food is good, but it's even better if you don't have to compost in the first place.
We're going to go left here, actually. I was thinking about going right, but that hill is steep, so we're not going to do that.
Tim may skip that hill, but not the client. Another thing that makes Tim's food service different from others is that he delivers his loads directly to low-income apartments.
If you have your own, like, plastic bin, I know that there's probably some underneath the cold table.
Oh, just check around.
Is that all right? Does that bother you? Cool.
One resident described the weekly drop-offs as Pavlovian, people waiting at the door to get the best pickings, and even getting upset if a week is missed. Jenkins believes delivering food directly to people relieves the stigma of waiting in line at a food bank or going to the grocery store to use their SNAP cards.
And none of that really is present with this system or this model. All you're really doing is you're staying within your apartment complex.
At the end of the trip, Tim saves an apple for himself.
That's pretty much it, man. That's all there is to it.
And I watch him take a bite.
Doesn't quite have that satisfying crunch because, you know, like, it's sort of on its way out. So. But it's still a great apple.
Matt Martin, KUOW News.
I'm not sure I've got it in me to go up Yesler, so we're not going to do that.
And you're listening to The Record from KUOW. This morning on KUOW, you might have heard NPR's Kelly McEvers talking with conservative commentator Pat Buchanan.
Explain to me what having a diverse cultural identity and a diversity of languages, how that undermines the American identity. I think it's important to try to understand why you think that this is such a threat.
Well, first, it seems that the American people tend to agree with us, does it not?
But what you are laying out is an America that is white, or if not exclusively white.
It's an America like the country I grew up in, which was a pretty good country.
In 1992, Pat Buchanan was a Republican candidate for president, and he made what's now known as the Culture Wars speech. He praised the traditional family values of the 1950s and argued the GOP needed to take America back to those values. Also in 1992, Olympia-based author Stephanie Kuntz wrote a book called The Way We Never Were. She called the golden age of family values from the 1950s a myth and warned against using nostalgia to make policy. Her updated version of that book examines the last 25 years of American family life and how our misconceptions about family life in the 1950s are still shaping our decisions about the future.
Families were not as harmonious as sometimes think. A lot of what we would now call child abuse was perfectly acceptable punishment. There was a lot of domestic violence, and it wasn't treated seriously by police. Most police had a stitch rule that unless a certain number of stitches were involved, you wouldn't arrest the guy. And many of them instructed the police to ask the woman what she had done to, start this. So these were not happy families, and we know now because of the number of women who, after they read The Feminine Mystique and other books from the early 60s, and then decided that this was really talking to them, that many women were desperately unhappy in these families.
Well, when you wrote your book in 1992, there were lots of conservative writers and pundits who were predicting doom for the future of the American family, basically. What were they saying?
Well, they were saying, first of all, that women's entry into the workforce would mean that children would be neglected, that women would stop being able to be good wives and mothers, that men wouldn't want to marry them. They predicted that with the rise of divorce, that fatherless children would be raised, and there were rising rates of unwed motherhood and divorce. Both sides of the political aisle in the 1990s were predicting a wave of super predators. That's what it was called by the leading criminologists. These immoral children spawned by unwed mothers who would lead to this shocking increase in violence, and violence would overrun America. This turned out to be completely wrong. Now what we're seeing is that the very things that scared people are the really good things for families. It is women and men in dual earner families with highly educated women who are the ones most concerned to spend a lot of developmental time with their kids. Men have stepped up to the plate at home in response to women's demands. And when men do step up to the plate at home, those families have less chance of divorce. It used to be that if a woman had more education than her husband, she was more likely to get divorced. Now that is no longer a divorce risk, and educated women did used to not get married. Now they're the most likely, high-earning and high-educated women are the most likely to get married and stay married. And when we look at the European scene, where this sort of change in egalitarian relationships is combined with good work family supports, we see that it's having a homemaker family that is the biggest divorce risk today. So there's been this tremendous turnaround that's been very healthy for families, even though there are obviously, there's a learning curve, and it's not always easy to change habits that were imposed on us for 200 years.
Well, you made some predictions about family life as well when you wrote that book. What did you get right?
Well, I got right that super predators weren't going to take over the country. As a matter of fact, since 1992, despite the fact that the unwed birth rate has risen to 40%, the juvenile crime rate has fallen by 60%. But I made some wrong predictions myself. You know, I was pretty confident that I didn't think that same-sex marriage would get very far. Back in 1992, three-quarters of Americans thought homosexuality was immoral and didn't deserve any protection. As late as 2004, 60% of Americans still opposed granting gays and lesbians the right to marry. So I wrote in the 2000 introduction to the 1992 book, which I did not revise at that time, I just wrote a new introduction, that I thought that this issue of same-sex marriage would be with us for a long, long time. But on the other hand, maybe some of the controversy over abortion and reproductive rights would go away with these new pills that made abortion more private and that made abortion less necessary because some of the pills just prevent the egg from implanting. Boy, was I wrong on that.
Well, we've talked about what you got right in 1992. We talked about what you got wrong in 1992. But what hasn't changed for the American family since the early 90s?
Back in 1993, we passed this very, very limited Family Medical Leave Act that only applied to less than 50% of Americans, but it gave them unpaid leave for family and medical emergencies.
So it essentially just protected their jobs.
Yes, and it only protected half of workers' jobs. And of course, what it meant is that many, many Americans could not afford to take leave. One recent survey found that almost a quarter of women went back to work after 2 weeks. Which is just stunning. Since 1993, every wealthy industrial nation in the world has instituted much longer leaves. They've made them paid leaves for women. Most of them have instituted paid paternity leaves so men can get it, and we have not budged. Only 13% of American workers are entitled to paid leaves. This is such a tragedy in a time period when we know how important it is to bond, when women want to be in the workforce and don't want to sacrifice their workforce for the fact that they also want to be family members, and men want to be family members. They don't want to have to sacrifice their fatherhood and their connections to their kids in order to be breadwinners. So that's one bad thing that really hasn't changed.
I'm wondering, as you watch this presidential election season, what parallels do you see between the family narrative you talked about in 1992 and the narrative of today?
Well, certainly we've seen, at least among Senator Cruz, who just got out, on Marco Rubio, and many of the traditional social conservatives, we've seen a revival of this idea that somehow we could avoid dealing with all of the economic and technological and regulative problems that have led to this increasing economic insecurity and inequality in our society if we could just get everybody to get married and stay married. And that was what they were saying in 92. It was wrong in 92. It's wrong today. The fact is, the research overwhelmingly shows that although single parenthood certainly makes raising kids more challenging, it's much more often a result of chronic economic stress and interpersonal stress and conflict. And so it's a result of it. And if you force the same two people to stay together, their kids would not necessarily end up better. In fact, they might end up worse. So that's one thing that keeps coming up. What I've noticed in this particular presidential cycle, though, is that liberals and conservatives are also jumping on the nostalgia bandwagon. You know, Trump says, let's make America great again. And Hillary Clinton answers, let's make America whole again. And I just wonder where in the past they think they can go back to do that. I think Trump thinks about the greatness of the 60s and 70s when we were the major player in the world. And you know, that's not going to come back unless we are prepared to do a whole lot of changes in our economic and political structure. And it's certainly not going to come back militarily, because we just no longer have the only game in town. And I think Clinton wants to go back to the 90s, but that was the era when the Confederate flag flew over most of the state capitals in the South. You were getting all of this talk about super predators. You got a reform of, quote, reform of welfare laws, which has left more people living in extreme poverty than were living in extreme poverty at that time. And you didn't even have climate change on the agenda, really, at that time. So there's all these sort of new problems we have to step forward and meet, and new gains, such as the real increase in interpersonal democracy and respect for children's rights and for women's rights and for gay and lesbian rights that we didn't have then. So we can build on the victories of the past, but we should not pretend we can go back to the past.
Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia. Her book, The Way We Never Were, was first published in 1992. A revised and updated version is out now. And that's The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Bill Radke's back for Week in Review tomorrow.